Dr. Hill Explains, where I invite you to join the science teaching conversation with me about Episode 2 of Stanford Encyclopedia of Philosophy, Giles of Rome, and fascinating. He himself has three periods, sort of a classical period, a period out in the wilderness where he's on the wrong side of a church ruling and then back swept into power for a while, right up to the top, and then backs the wrong pope and gets out again, producing a huge body of work. And it's more of an intellect mind, sort of surprisingly grounding the Augustan order in the works of Augustus, which is a sort of a late Roman Empire. Augustus is in the Roman Empire, there's no doubt about it. Last vestiges of the Roman Empire, he sees the Vandals coming over. I don't know what year that would be. Don't have to think of it. It's got a whole lot of ancient scripts, so he's a bit of a deeper thinker. And sort of middle ages. He's involved in that transition, that awful transition between scholastic thinking Aristotelian thinking, which is sort of a more systematic viewpoint. Now, I considered Aquinas as the extreme example of the scholastic thinking. However, he was a relative revolutionary, and so he sort of moved the revolution forward. So Aristotle was a way of systematic thinking with systematic thinking with a very poor quality control going in. That's Aristotle thinking. That's how I'd say it. Sort of authoritative, at low quality control, and then scholastic thinking is completely book. It's written. It's sort of like almost happy clappy thinking, but sort of it's not even systematic, but with high quality control. So, they've sort of got the high quality control of the actual books and consistency in scholastic stuff, without the actual systematic thinking behind it. Whereas Aristotle had the high quality control, but without this huge army of people looking at it, it wasn't corporatized. So it's sort of like this really interesting mix, and out of it has bubbled some basic physics concepts. So that's my interest in it. We're in part 3, episode 2, part 3 of the metaphysics. Traditionally, Giles was described as a faithful to the discipline of Aquinas. So, Aquinas is the Dominican super theologian who, as far as I could say, had the scholastic viewpoint. So he wrote the Summa Theologica, and you read through it, and it's pretty absolutely dinky die, crank the handle. I've got my methodology. I ask so many questions for and against, and I just grind through everything and just argue the correct answer. So it's sort of, to me, it sounds like full-on rhetoric and the sort of the old way of thinking, but evidently not. It was revolutionary. So nowadays, such a judgment is not accepted by scholars. Oh, well, I wouldn't have said so. After Concito Luna argued persuasively in favour of the authenticity of Reportatio, it became, so we indeed have, he wrote this, so there are certain things that he didn't write. It became clear that Giles already in the first stages of a career develops his position, taking Aquinas' teaching as a starting point for his own reflection, but criticizes and corrects doctrines of the Dominican master in many aspects. Luna, this person, could also establish that Giles reworked his lecture on the sentences, handed down to us as reportero into an ordinato, only for the first two books. However, while the first book was completed shortly after the lectura, that is, during the years 1271 to 1273, the second book had to wait to completion to 1309. Mm-hmm. So, yep. So, just in memory, just to clue in, Giles was just a standard run-of-the-mill academic in Paris, got on the wrong side of a power break, was put in the wilderness for a long time. And then, 1309, he's back in his heyday. Again, so it's pretty hard to work out how this means. Luna gathered impressive evidence suggesting that Ordinato of the third book that goes under the name of Giles is in fact spurious. It's so hard. Now, what's so amazing is at the time it's not only that, there was just fakes and frauds everywhere. There were fraudulent possession documents, you know, the Titles Act. People come up with the church, they want a piece of land, they come up with the church already owns that. See this ancient one, it's signed by Saint So-and-so. So it's like the church and fraud was just synonymous. And, Richard. Oh, I've got to think of his name. There's another famous person. I'm just racking my brain. I had his name on my tip of my tongue before. But he looked at the donation of Constantine. It's sort of like, you know, it's like buying documents or trading documents in the Middle Ages is like buying relics from the sort of stand outside the pyramids. People will swear blind it's okay, and there could be a good one in there, but the majority of them are pretty fake. There's fakes everywhere. Fakes there. So, I've got a Richard of. No. I'll come back to me the name of the person who. Everyone was dealing with fakes. It's such a medieval thing to have a fake thing, a spurious book. Broadly speaking, Giles' philosophical project tends to discuss critically Aquinas' position in order to improve the solutions he offered, without, however, trying to discard them radically. Recently, Catherine Cron Parlong showed that this is the case for the debate about the natural desire for knowledge, although defended in the context of a discussion of Henry of Jaunt, Giles' position does not coincide with Aquinas's. According to him, in fact, human beings possess a natural desire for knowledge that is satisfied by a limited understanding of separate substances. Same holds true for one of the most famous topics of his discussion with Henry of Ghent, the distinction between essence and existence. See, this is just getting very, very close to matter and physics. For someone who's really looking at, you know, it's sort of like you're going for a genuine part and you go in, the box isn't there, but there's a small note saying you can buy it in the suburb over here, and you keep on searching it, and this is essence. Essence and existence. In this case, Giles radicalizes Aquinas' doctrine of real distinction by asserting that existence must be conceived as res addita, things added to an essence. Although the final result of the theory was considered closer to Avicenna's solution to that of Aquinas, Giles nevertheless develops it as a starting from Aquinas' own position. As emerges already from his questions on metaphysics, the connection of this issue with the discussion with Henry Jaunt about the concept of creation was investigated in depth by Giorpini, who could show that Giles, while defending Aquinas and thereby possibility of using one of the historical principles in an orthodox account of creation, goes beyond the position of the Dominican master. So Aquinas is something, it's my, I don't know, I'll have to read about Aquinas. I've read the Summa Theologica. There's not much to read in the Summa Theologica. It's just, you'd have to be a real scholar to pick out anything really interesting in it. So it's, this is the books that I've read of them. So the Dominican Master, asserting the Identity Essay and Creatio, Giles advocated comparability with Aristotle and Dockland, with Christian also in his commentary on the short treatise De Bonifortia attributed to Aristotle, but in reality consisting of a compilation of passages taken from Ethica, Inimia, and Magna Moralia. So even he was dealing with fake Aristotle. You know, this is just, it's beyond, it's a complete mess. The interpretation of the concept of bona fortuna is, in those texts, implied problemas connected with contingency, necessarily the interplay between divine causality and natural events. As Valerie Cordonnier showed, Giles' solution was attacked by Henry of Ghent as leading to necessitarianism. Now firstly, I've got some comments here. That it seems that this seems an area of philosophy thoroughly covered by Italian women. It seems to be something a really interesting area of philosophy. But necessitarianism sounds like the mafia to me. It's necessary. I break your legs. I've got to do this. Okay, here we go. As to the debate about the unicity of substantial form, Giles' position evolves during time. If we leave aside the errors of philosophium, since the authenticity of this work has been contested with serious arguments, that's a fair number of serious, we can notice that Giles changes his position from contra gradus et pluretum formarium between the end of 2077 and the beginning of 1277 and 1278, where he, against Henry of Ghent, denies plurality of forms for every compound, to later works where he takes a more cautious stance, in particular concerning man. You know, I really wouldn't mind a flow diagram here, say a timeline, a flow diagram, and arguments, so I could see it out rather than having to build this mental machinery. The principle of individualization is identified, as in Aquinas, with materia signata quanta. So this is getting really back to atomism and monism about, can any individual thing exist? It's hard to get your mind around it. That is matter designated by dimensions. According to Giles, who criticized Richard of Meldiva on this point, matter is purely potentiality and therefore cannot be distinguished into different kinds. So you can sort of see this is a really confused way he's going to get with mass. For this reason, he cannot accept Aquinas' doctrine that the incorruptibility of celestial bodies arises from the peculiar nature of their matter. I didn't pick that up from Aquinas, but there you go. That Aquinas is saying they're incorruptible, so they have a different type of matter. God, that's whack. In Giles' opinion, celestial bodies are not incorruptible because their matter is different from the matter of sublunar bodies, but rather because their quantus materia cannot change its determinate dimensions. Yeah, you've got to understand that people said the universe has got divine. Aristotle said there is. If you go above the moon, things orbit forever. They go in perfect circles, and everything's circular, and it's a perfect thing. But beneath the moon, things fall to the ground. And of course, Bacon had an intermediate thing. He had rather than a digital effect. He had as a slowly switching on and off things. And it's so interesting to read these philosophers that you go, oh, modern, oh my God. I think what something really hit me is Francis Bacon, the Elizabethan philosopher. So comets really hurt people. They found it really hard to understand comets. And he said, you know, science, science, science. Oh, comet means there's going to be pestilence. Like, it doesn't take much for these people to drop back. So he actually, Giles is actually into different types of matter. So he's looking at, Giles is looking at dimensions of things. But one application of Giles' famous doctrine of indeterminate dimensions, modifying Averroes' doctrine in this respect, Giles argues that a portion of matter, in order to be able to receive a form, needs to possess already a sort of quantity. Oh, so... he's getting on to mass. Jeez, is that so close? Such quantity, however, should not be identified with the determinate dimensions of that a body possesses, but rather a quantus, which remains the same during the processes such as rarefaction and condensation. There's not evaporation, but I think Giles' notion of quantus materia, which is not generally an extension of three-dimensionality, but seems to represent an unchangeable given amount of matter pertaining to a body, has been considered comparable, some difficulties notwithstanding, to the modern notion of mass. So, you can sort of, I mean, this is where I really find this absolutely fascinating. So, he's, the way that he's bouncing off it is not necessarily the, he's trying to work out, he's sort of figured it out, he's sort of fallen out of just sort of bumbling along, trying to work out what Aristotle's saying, and criticizing one, he's sort of bumbled into it. It's not necessarily the transubstantiation, which I don't know where that comes in. I haven't seen that again. Surely this will be referred to here, although it could be referred to here. So he's trying to, he's actually found mass. I could see mass coming out of this ever so slightly. So it's got to have something not associated with its form. Isn't that incredible? A quantity not associated with its form. Gee, I'm going to have to... It's so mentally mind-bendingly hard to understand. After the condemnation of 1277, a significant change can be noted in Giles' position, also in his solution to the problem of eternity of the world. At the beginning of his career, he admitted the theoretical possibility of the eternity of the world, although rejecting Aristotle's argument providing the actual eternity of the world. So Aristotle says, if the world's always existed, it always will. But I dare you to... Well, you can read his arguments. They are just page after page of mind-bending. Oh, enough to blow your head off. Later, he shifted to a more Augustine stance, rejecting the hypothesis of creation ab aeterno and admitting that it is possible to prove the temporality of creation, although he finds no conclusive arguments has been advanced so far. Giles was much more steadfast in his opposition to another major tenet of Averroistic doctrine, that is, the unicity of the possible intellect. He maintained that the possibility of actual knowledge on the part of an individual depends necessarily on the fact that each body is informed by its own intellective soul, which is its form, my godfather. For the same reason, Giles also rejected the unicity of the agent intellect, a doctrine attributed to Avicenna. Well, that's... It's hard to say. These people were handling so many big issues at the same time, and to us, we tend to not focus on the things, issues that they think these are really big issues from. He's trying to work out, what has soul? Do I think differently? Is my soul causing me to behave this way? It's just, you know, is the moon made of a different type of matter or is it not? All this type of stuff. But the thought that he was trying to solve the transubstantiation. Seems a bit weird, but he might find it out. So his natural philosophy, which is his metaphysics was his philosophy, his natural philosophy. Well, if he wasn't doing natural philosophy, coming up with what matter is, I don't know what it is. Okay. Natural philosophy. Recent studies concerning Giles' natural philosophy focus mainly on his treatment of some pivotal concept in Aristotle's physics. Celia Trifolgi opened new perspectives in this field, devoting her attention to the notions of place and motion, especially the void, underlying Giles' emphasis on the role of place in the description of motion seems to lead a quantitative and relational notion of place. Giles, however, does not completely substitute the Aristotelian notion of place for that of place as distance. You have to really understand it. You can read Aristotle. They couldn't get speed. They could say traveled so far in so much time, but they couldn't divide time and distance. And they couldn't have distance. It's so hard to get your mind around what was holding up these ancient Greeks. It held up the Romans, and, volume of object was about as far as they could go, although they did fantastic calculation machines. The other, which is related to material place, assumes an intrinsic connection between place and the located body that cannot be unfounded on distance alone. Trifolgi also investigated Giles' notion of time and infinity, emphasizing that his whole approach to natural philosophy is distinguished by the tendency towards a metaphysical interpretation of the Aristotelian concept as opposed to a physical quantitative one. That would be interesting. For example, Giles conceives of time not only as a quantity pertaining to every kind of motion, but rather a mode in which motion exists. His concept of time rests on the fact, essentially, on a broad notion of succession, which allows him, on one hand, to retain unity of concept of time, but on the other hand, to acknowledge the existence of different temporal forms. That's really interesting. So he's got another aspect of matter being intrinsic, and it is conserved over time. This is really interesting. This attitude emerges from an analysis of Giles' controversy on the angelic time with angelic time? What? With Henry of Jont, but also faces the... But both horses thought that time in which angels exist, unlike sublunar time, as a discrete succession of incidents. Giles and Henry disagreed, however, on the relationship existing between angelic and sublunar time. So they are really trapped in the Aristotelian world. That's incredible. So there's time outside. Sublunar is obviously where the angels exist. In particular, Henry rejects Giles' thesis that more instants of angelic time can correspond to one and the same instance of sublunar time. This difference of opinion rested in part on divergent concepts of angelic motion, which can be instantaneous according to Henry, but not according to Giles. So you can see here the angelic time is one of the basic ideas that have actually crept through Newton. He does not have the speed of light. He has angelic times as instant action. That is, he doesn't have gravity travelling at the speed of light. He has gravity as instantaneously. If you look at the gravity wave, it is the position as it is. It's as seen. The gravity field comes from the planet where the planet is seen. So that gravity is travelling towards you at the speed of light. So when you see a planet over here, you feel a gravitational wave. You know, it's not like watching a jet overhead. You know, these sonic objects, you hear the boom from over there, and you look up. I remember the blues, was it Blue Angels in Palo Alto? You'd see these Zeus jets. You hear the sonic boom on the horizon, and the jet would be flying way above you, virtually above you. For the sonic boom, you get the feel of the sonic boom, and then track forward. You know, and so they have angelic time, and of course, Newton has angelic time. He has an absolute frame of reference. This is really interesting. I find that super interesting. Between philosophy and medicine, my godfather, this is absolutely fascinating stuff. So, it is interesting that Newton has actually picked up on something called angelic time, which of course Einstein defends with, but no one knows of because everyone is too conceited. In 2008, Romana Martorelli Vico published the first critical edition of Giles' De Formanti Corpus Humani in Utero. With this work completed between 1285 and 1295, Giles took a stance in much debated question of receptive roles of male and female parents in conception. Oh, wow. Oh, God. Wow. Who would have thought? So what are the roles? The Galenist view, dating back to Hippocrates, that both male and female contributed sperm, so that the offspring could have the characteristics of both parents. On the contrary, Aristotle held that only the male alone contributed sperm containing the active formal principle of conception, while the female provided only the matter of the fetus. Isn't that beautiful? The sperm, somehow, obviously, have a sperm. Sperm is just the form, the actual form, and the cause one. You add cause one, cause two, equals baby. Isn't it? So the sperm is just forming juice. It's sort of like baby accelerant. It doesn't go together. Giles was well acquainted with these different positions and made efforts to reconcile diverging approaches of medicine and philosophy, which could be traced back to Avicenna. Now, which is really weird. This is another person. Avicenna. Leaning on Avicenna's collegiate, however, Giles rejected any attempt to attribute a formal role to female sperm, even if it conceived as subordinate to the male one. Female and male sperm. They had no idea of eggs, of course. There was different sperm. Okay. On contrary, he maintained that it contributed only in a passive way to conception, whilst he called female sperm, i.e. the virginal secretion, as subservient, helpful, but by no means necessary function. Okay, gee, amazing. So they thought the lubrication, okay, it helps the male sperm to inseminate female matter, but does not add anything essential to the new beam. In this way, Giles, is it true that the Galen view is pretty wild as well? In this way, Giles intended to stress the superiority of the philosophical theoretical approach to such problems with respect to traditions of medical learning, even when they seem to be supported by empirical evidence. Empirical evidence such as the resemblance of the offspring to the mother, e.g., was explained away as an example of the stronger resistance of female matter to the action of form. After conception, the human embryo begins a development which goes through different stages. Comparing the stages of the embryo of various animals, Giles, like Thomas Aquinas and Aristotle, embryology is the most amazing. So Aristotle tried to answer the chicken egg question. He became famous on that one. Supported the interpretation of fetal embryo, which was exploited by many centuries later by the so-called recapitulation theory. Giles maintained, however, that the organic fetal body is not to be called a pig, a bear, or a monkey, but something immediately disposed to becoming a man. This position apparently implies that human life does not fully begin at the moment of conception. Although such a thesis can be brought to bear on moral judgment concerning abortion, Giles does not seem interested in tackling this point from a view an issue which would become central for what's nowadays in bioethics. Which is true, like the early fetuses looked as though they could become anything. And isn't that absolutely fascinating? That just does my head in. So, so there's two secretions make a baby. The secretions, they look like form making the sperm. They know that sperm is form making, and they've also picked up that embryology goes with the fact that we've all emerged from the same animal, and so as our all embryos of most animals look exactly alike. Ethics and political theory. Wow, this doesn't get any better. The problem is I really want to remember all this, but it's just so bad. Ethics. So, Galen believed that there was a female sperm. Is that what? In the debate of respective roles of intellect with determination of human action, Giles is known to have taken the immediate position, a sort of composite between theory of Henry of Junt and Geoffrey of Fontaine's. Giles maintains, in fact, that will is a passive potency and cannot, quote, move itself, but always needs an object, a bonum apristum. The starting point, however, does not rule out its freedom, because will, once moved by its object, can determine itself of other potencies with regard to action. This view of Giles is consistent with his interpretation of the relationship existing between knowledge and will in the sinner. Committing sins implies an ignorance of the real good, but this ignorance is not the primary cause of the wrong behaviour, because it's an effect of the will, which is affected by malicia, corrupts judgments of the reason. Which is rather interesting. I think we should really ask a few more questions ourselves about why people do wrong things. Or why people who do wrong things don't feel bad. Yeah, that's a good question. And here is the fundamental question. So, again, I'm still blown away by the birds and the bees aspect of it. But it's really interesting in that they've got the basic laws of motion drumming around there, but out in the philosophical field, is it will and bodies of motion. Giles of Rome exerted considerable influence also in other fields of ethics, such as theories of virtue. So I'm just really trying to get across it. So he had angelic time and non-angelic time, like this, two types of time, instantaneous time, and also, I just can't get my head around it, things had matter. I've just got to really reread that several times over to get it. The matter one, I just can't get my head around that. He said there's got to be, besides, he's got himself into matter by this really complex route. It wasn't just simply explaining something, which is rather a bit of a pitiful thing. It was, there is stuff out there, and it's, I'm going to have to really read that several times. Giles of Rome exerted considerable influence in other fields of ethics, such as the theory of virtues, which is the idea of virtues from Plato. The modest development expression of his position is not found in the commentary on Aristotle, but rather in his De Regium Principillum. This most successful mirror of princes of medieval political thought, which is still conserved in more than 300 manuscripts in the original Latin version, to which many translations in European vernaculars were added. Written most probably between 2077 and 2080, De Regium is acknowledged to be one of the most successful attempts at mediating Aristotle's practical philosophy, and its particular with his ethical and political language, into Latin West, whatever that means, the Latin West. Giles was the first to structure a mirror of princes in three books along the lines of a scheme, Ethica, Economica, and Politica, which played an important role in the reception of Aristotle's moral and political philosophy in the Middle Ages. The author takes great care to give the impression that he is mainly relying on Aristotle's text, providing numerous quotations from Nicomachean Ethics and Republics and Rhetorics, but Nicomachean Ethics turns out not to be from Aristotle. This is such a mind-bending period. You know what the entire thing is? I am a weak person. The sex thing has actually blown. The matter thing is. The matter thing, again, is just really taking holus bolus, this sublunar matter. Angelic matter. That's amazing. You know what? And we teach angelic time at school. And of course, once you've got angelic time, these people can't do quantum mechanics. Our school kids can't do quantum mechanics for the same reason. Scholars should not overlook, however, that his reception of Aristotle is not as direct as it can be seen, as it can seem, and that Giles is deeply influenced by the tradition of the interpretation of Aristotle's practical philosophy. In this tradition, Aquinas plays a very important role for Giles, so that when Aristotle is, I think, what Giles, Aristotle called him the great, no, Aquinas called him the great man. It was really interesting, Aristotle. Aristotle didn't refer to anybody, so he said, the great man. I forget that's what he said. So Aquinas is a Dominican, also in Italy, and a great, great thinker. So St. Thomas Aquinas. Okay. Dominicans. Okay. Aquinas, who, with his Centini Libera Politicum and De Reno Summa Theologica, I've read the Summa Theologica, it's a really decisive influence on De Regima. And when discussing particular topics, Giles skillfully adapts Aristotle to his own purposes. This emerges with clarity in this first book devoted to ethics, where Giles' classification of virtues is heavily dependent on the Summa Theologica, and therefore on Aquinas' reinterpretations of the Aristotelian heritage. For example, Giles I must admit, I didn't actually see, when I read the Summa Theologica, any Aristotle in it, but it must be. He defines prudentia as a virtuous vitis medias, sharing the nature of moral as well as intellectual ones, a doctrine which has by no means be traced back to Stagirati. In the second books, Giles deals with the ethics of a man as head of the family, covering many topics from children rearing to education, the rule over servants. To this purpose, he exploits a wide range of sources and also medicine authors. Giles wrote his De Regime, the pseudo-Aristotelian O Economa, were not yet available in translation the Latin ways. Still, he managed to discuss also economic topics as far as they were relevant for household of a royal family or for a high-class household in general. There he condemns usury, criticizes other economic practices that are not suitable for a prince, and insists on the primary role of agriculture should play. What? So he's an economic genius? Like, it's really interesting that these various people do have flings economically, but they're not. It's all economics associated with virtue. So usury and virtue, or was so-and-so virtue? Thales. Did Aristotle think Thales was virtuous? Yes, he did. He made money. Sort of interesting in a way. The most famous example of a selective attitude towards Aristotle's works, however, belongs rather to the field of political theory. In the third book of De Regime, Giles wants to prove that monarchy is absolutely the best form of government. I think what I like is Locke said we should have religious freedom except for Jesuits. You know, it was beautiful, beautiful founding ideas behind America, blah, 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 blah. But we still must actually do Jesuits in the neck. And here it is, he wants to say monarchy is... Then some arguments against monarchy, which could be read in politics, are represented as objections that Aristotle puts forth for subsequent refutation. Which is really interesting, because you listen there, I love the objection. At the end, Giles states squarely that Aristotle supports monarchy as the absolutely best form of monarchy and... At the end, Giles states squarely that Aristotle supports monarchy as the absolutely best form of monarchy and collaborates his assertion with an argument which, in the politics, actually goes in the opposite direction. One could provide several other examples to show that De Regime succeeded in representing itself as a simplified exposition of explanation of Aristotle's thought on practical philosophy, but at the same time is transmitted to Giles readers a strongly biased interpretation of Stag Rioti, whoever that chap was. In fact, De Regime was often used as a tool to have easier access to Aristotle's political theory, deeply influenced, therefore, the way Latin West read and understood Aristotle politics in the late Middle Ages. There you go. Is that a bit more interesting? Well, I find it's just not Aristotle does this, it's Aristotle goes through intermediary who supports the system. Recent codeological studies on the diffusion of the regime's manuscripts do in fact show that many possessors of the manuscripts most probably use them for study. Graham McLear, 1999, pointed to the fact that Giles' commentary on the sentences had almost neglected as a source of Giles' political philosophy. Studying distinctions 22 and 20 and 44 of Book 2, he found that in these texts, Giles accounts for the origin of political authority among human beings after the fall. This is where you get kicked out of, this is another thing. The fall, as everyone knows, it's sort of like, we have the Great Depression, we have the fall. The fall is sort of like, the Great Depression, Great Flood. It diverges from one can read in De Regime Principle and reveals the profound influence of Augustine. While Aristotle does not play the important role he had in Giles's, Mirror for Princes. One should also take into consideration that Giles Ordinato of the second book was completed in 1309. That's at least 25 years after De Regime and could be witness to the evolution of Giles' thought. As a matter of fact, the much earlier Reportatio does tackle such issues at all. While De Regime, Giles carefully avoids any reference to the thorny problem of the relationship between secular and ecclesiastical power. His later writings are relevant for political theory deal first and foremost with ecclesiological problems. This holds true for his treatise De Reunitate Papae, where Giles defends the lawfulness of Sistine's abdication against the arguments put forward by the Colonna Cardinals in their first appeal to benefits the A's. From the point of view of the history of political thought, it is relevant that Giles argues that papal power, although of divine origin, is conferred on a particular individual by a human act, namely by election of the cardinals. Here, Giles is countering the colonial argument that the papal dignity cannot cease to reside in the Pope until he dies, because the pontificate depends on God's wills and stresses the fact that divine intention in the case becomes effected through the mediation of human agents, that is, through the consent of electors to be elected. A jurisdiction which is given by consent of men, however, can be removed by the consent through the reverse procedure. This does not amount to saying that the Pope can be deposed except the case of heresy, because according to Giles, the Pope is above the law and has no earthly authority above him. He can, however, dispose himself, that is, abdicate. Just as for his election and consent of his electors to be elected where necessary, so also for the removal of the Pope from the office, his consent is decisive. In this way, Giles could dismiss arguments against the validity of Celestinian's abdication without admitting the possibility that the Pope can be deposed by the council, as Boniface's adversaries maintained. Gotcha there. It's whether your Pope does it. And it's really interesting whether this type of feeling that in this thing, I think in a lot of dodgy things, they build a straw man up and say that he didn't look after himself, therefore we can treat him badly. And that is that you acquiesce to being treated badly. Much better known than De Renunzione is Giles' De Ecclesia Potestate, a treatise also composed in defence of Boniface VIII, most probably in 1302. Giles systematically expounded in his work the views on the relationship between regem and sacrorum. He had already put forward a rediscovered sermon held of the papal curia. The main tenet of his fully-fledged argumentation is that the Pope, supreme authority of the Church, but also the whole of mankind, is the only legitimate origin of every power on earth, be it exercised as jurisdiction on persons and or properties or things. In his plenitude of power, the Pope possesses an absolute supremacy both in a classical and temporal sphere, and delegates the exercise of temporal sword to lay sovereigns only in order to fulfill most properly his higher religious duties. Any authority that does not recognize its dependence on the papal power is but usurpation. In Giles's view, there is no space even for a partially autonomous temporal order. Oh, this is the Templar. That's the Templars, I'm sure he's going for it. Coherently, Giles maintains that no property rights are valid if they are not legitimated by papal authority. Increasingly, Richard de Cusa is the one who's the, that's the one, it's Richard de Cusa? Yeah, he's the one that was dealing with so much fraud. The problem is there's just so much fraud in the system. He doesn't seem as aware of it. Coherently, Giles maintained that no property rights are valid if they are not legitimate by papal authority. Increasingly enough, such a claim is supported by his account of the origin of property, according to which property is not a natural institution, but only a consequence of human agreements, the lack of any legitimacy unless they are recognized by supreme religious power. Well, this is the thing for me. I think money and property and it's all custom. It's really interesting. See, a triangle exists to be a triangle, but something no longer exists to be a property if you don't have a society sustain it. I find that an interesting thing. Scholarly discussion about De Ecclesia is still open. Hooray! Karl Ulb argues strongly arguments against the previous assumptions, as you would. But Giles wrote in reaction to John of Paris, De Regia Postella et Papo. While previous scholarship stressed the affinity in the form and content between De Ecclesia Postella and the famous bull Unum Sanctum. Francesco Bertoni holds that one should not overlook profound differences between concepts of papal power that inspire the two texts. Oh my god, have I finished the end? I've come to the end of this. My god, the bibliography. Oh, that was him. That's it. Two episodes, Giles of Rome. Okay. So the primary sources, the most complete list of Giles' works can be found in Dalpuna Donati Luna, 93, together with the most readable attempt, reliable attempt at dating them. The same article, etc. So I'm just going to go back. I've got 15 minutes, 10 minutes. Go back. Oh my goodness. I'm going to go back and read his. Is it Metaphysics? Is it Metaphysics? Just astounding. His mass. How did he come up with mass again? So that was. He was a mercifully short two episodes. Knocked him over in two episodes. Yeah, just, we'll get there soon. Okay, so I should. I'm just trying to think. It's whether something's created or not. It's essence created. Yeah, so. Just here, I don't know, there's no page numbers here. So. In Giles' opinion, celestial bodies are not incorruptible because their matter is different from other matters of sublunar bodies, but rather because their quantus materia cannot change its determinate dimensions. Right. This but one application of Giles' famous doctrine of indeterminate dimensions, modifying Averroes' doctrine in this respect. Giles argues that a portion of the matter, in order to be able to receive a form, needs to possess already a sort of quantity. Such quantity, however, should not be identified with the determinate dimensions a body possesses, but it's rather its quantus, which remains the same during the process such as rarefaction and condensation. So, they've lost their ability to change because they've contained mass. And that. Giles' notion of quantus materia, which is not only generically extension of three dimensionality, but seems to represent an untouchable given amount of matter pertaining to a body, has been considered comparable, some difficulties notwithstanding, to the notion of modern mass. Well, that's it. That's where he's gone. And then you've got whether. They've got no idea of eggs. They're just sperm eggs. That's very fascinating. Well, thanks a lot for reading. And we're mercifully through this philosopher in two episodes. Another podcast. Another story comes to a close. It's been a pleasure sharing this moment in time with you. May you discover truly amazing things, understand them, and tell others. Thanks for listening.